History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do a couple pretty simple things. First of all, think of a few good questions to ask. And second, devote some time to patiently listen as long-buried memories rise to the surface. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we become inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This coming Thursday, November 11th, will be Veterans Day, that one day a year where our nation pauses to express gratitude to all who have served. I imagine if you're somebody who values this program, you probably thank every veteran you encounter every day. But with Veterans Day coming on Thursday, why not start making a list right now of people that you want to go out of your way to thank for their service to our country? Wherever you're listening today, there will be Veterans Day observances, parades, banquets, assemblies. Get ahead of it. Look it up now so you can participate. And maybe, how about this? Think about the young people in your life who might benefit from participating too. If you're looking for something to watch on Veterans Day, November 11th, the History Channel will be debuting the documentary Hidden Heroes, The Nisei Soldiers of World War II. That's 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific for the time, and take a listen to the trailer.
It's not just a great Japanese-American story, it's a great American story.
Witness the untold bravery of World War II's Nisei soldiers.
Japanese men wanted to serve so badly.
They're the most decorated unit in military history.
And how they fought two battles.
They were fighting the Nazis, but they were also fighting racism of our nation.
They fought for the ideals of American democracy.
Hidden Heroes, The Nisei Soldiers of World War II, Thursday, November 11th at 8 on the History Channel.
Again, that's the trailer for the History Channel documentary Hidden Heroes, The Nisei Soldiers of World War II, debuting the evening of Veterans Day, November 11th at 8 p.m. I've had the privilege of interviewing World War II veterans every week since 2005, but the Go for Broke National Education Center has been doing it quite a bit longer. Their Hanashi Oral History Project began way back in 1998, and some of those memories they've diligently gathered for years are included in this documentary coming out Veterans Day. I'm really looking forward to checking it out. Hope you are too. And quite a few of the veterans they've recorded have also shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes. We've heard from many Americans of Japanese ancestry who fought for the very nation that was holding their families behind barbed wire. You've heard a lot about the Go for Broke soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team and the 100th Infantry Battalion, but maybe not as much about those Nisei veterans who served in the Military Intelligence Service. Clarence Suzuki is one of them. A favorite photo of his has him standing in front of the B-29 that helped end the war, the Enola Gay, but he was also there for the start of the war as a teenager on his native Oahu.
I was in Honolulu, Hawaii, when the bombs started falling. I was there.
What did that feel like? I mean, because I've talked to guys who were in the service already at that point, and for them they thought it was drills, it was maneuvers. They weren't that surprised until they saw the rising sun on the side of those Japanese planes. For you, when did you realize that something crazy was going on?
Well, that morning, I was going to Bible training class roughly on the corner of Makale and King Street in Honolulu. And the Bible training class was about 9:30. And I was at my friend's house about a block away from the church. I think about 8:30, maybe something like that. And then I heard a big bomb explosion about a block away. This was on the corner of King Street and Macaulay Street. And it was anchored by the Miyamoto department store and maybe around 10 other stores along King Street. So after the blast, we were kind of shook up what's going on. So we ran outside and kind of looked, and there was smoke. Shortly thereafter, the fire department showed up, and then within 5 minutes, the block was on fire. is spreading through all the stores. It burned the whole place down. But there was the fireman that carried a woman out, and she had her baby with her in her arms, but she was bleeding. And then that was my first exposure to what happened on that day, December 7th. But the fireman told us to go home and just stay there and listen to the radio, so I went home.
Well, and for people who haven't visited Honolulu, I'm just picturing in my mind, now Pearl Harbor is a couple miles west of what you're talking about. These are the streets of Honolulu, closer to Waikiki, just north of the beaches of Waikiki. In fact, I'll never look at that intersection the same now that you've told me that story. So this is not where all the boats or anything are. This is far away from what the attacks there. Had you had any indication before that something like this could happen? How big of a shock was it?
Well, in 1940, I think my recollection may not be historically correct, but during the summer of 1941, you know, now and then we were out to Waikiki Beach. Next door was Kuhio Beach. Waikiki was for the tourists. Kuhio Beach was for the locals. But during the summer, maybe twice a week, we'd be out there swimming, and I would notice that the aircraft carriers were out there on the horizon, sometimes three, sometimes none. But my understanding in 1941 summer was the islands were on red alert already. And if you, you know, read about December 7th, there's no acknowledgement that the islands were on red alert. But my recollection is that we were on red alert, namely because in the summer of 1940, Rear Admiral, he was one of the intelligence chiefs in Washington, but he said that Japan might attack Pearl Harbor. But in June of 1941, he says Japan is most likely to attack Pearl Harbor. So that's the kind of historic, you know, background that I have. But most of the media never acknowledged that the islands were on red alert.
Well, I guess it probably wasn't politically expedient at the time, because they wanted it to play out as a sneak attack, and that would get America together in a different way. I'm curious, as someone who was Japanese American living on the island of Oahu, did you know immediately that it was Imperial Japan that had attacked? And did it strike you that this might be tough to be a Japanese American on that island after the attacks?
Yes. After I saw the explosion and the fire on Macaulay and King, the firemen told us to go home, stay there. So within a couple of days, message from the authorities was to stay indoors, don't turn on the lights at night. But it turns out that everybody wondered what happened on the Macaulay and King fire, explosion and fire. As it turned out, Pearl Harbor anti-aircraft guns were shooting at the planes, and some of the shells did not detonate as they were supposed to up in the air. They came down on the ground and exploded. And the same thing was in the city of Honolulu. My understanding was about 260 civilians were killed by our own artillery fire, the bombs exploding in the city of Honolulu.
And you came, I guess, fairly close to being another one added to that tally. How far away were you from these explosions and that fire?
Oh, that fire on Macaulay, I was only about a block away, pretty close. See, because I was going to the Olivet Baptist Church for Bible training, but we had to go early and meet at my friend's house, and that was the location that was so close to the bomb. But the church was only another block, Mauka, you know, north, where we were meeting at the Suemori's house.
So in the wake of this, I mean, and as America found out, and everyone who I've ever interviewed has a memory of how they first found out about these attacks, you found out before just about anybody because you were right there. But in the weeks and the months that followed, what was life like there? And when did you realize that your life might end up changing a little bit?
Well, we just had to stay indoors. The instructions were coming over the radio that you should, you know, dig a bomb shelter. And every home would be supplied with some lumber or whatever to make a bomb shelter. So my father and I, we had to pick and shovel in the front yard to build a bomb shelter. But it was kind of messy too, because, you know, all that, you know, dirt and stuff like that, and you had to have lumber to cover up the sort of a tunnel that you dug, just barely, you know, enough for a couple of three people. After that, you had to put the black cloth over the windows, and you couldn't have any light shining at night. But we managed. We got some black cloth and some low incandescent lamps. We managed to be in a blackout. And then the school said, yeah, we're going to be school coming out. But this was now around February of 1942. So all the kids went back to school. From that point on, I think the military was, you know, getting more and more secure about Japan not attacking and landing in the Hawaiian Islands.
And that's the thing. I don't want to look past that, because we know now that Japan didn't come back and conquer the islands as they might have been able to had they struck at the right time. But it must have been a constant state of fear for you there, having seen what they did on December 7th, that they might come back. How did you deal with that?
Well, we all worried about that, you know, that the Japan armed forces might return. But in the meantime, the military governor, General Emmons, allowed the University of Hawaii ROTC guys to form the Victory Volunteer Soldiers. And there was another group of Niseis that were already in the U.S. Army. They got booted out. And there was another group in the Territorial Guard. So these three groups formed later on the nucleus of the 100th Infantry Battalion. School started, and we tried to get back to normalcy, but things were not normal. I mean, we didn't have the regular teachers. My teacher, Dr. Daiho Chan, he was a major, and he didn't come back to school because he had an ROTC commission. And we had another teacher called Mrs. Evans. She was not up to snuff. But we managed to, you know, go through all this period. And I graduated from McKinley High School in 1943. At that time, they were asking for volunteers. And I asked my papa, and he said, no, don't go. But the others, they went, like Senator, you know, Dan Inouye. He was a year older than me. I think he was in the university already, but he volunteered. And some of my classmates volunteered also. They became the nucleus of the 442nd. And I met Senator Inouye in Washington, and I told Senator, you know, you were in McCully and Bingham Track, and I was in McCully down on Date Street. And he opened his eyes and said, oh, you know, he didn't say anything. I said, no, you know, Dan, you were in the Troop 36, the Boy Scouts of America, and we met at the YMCA once a month. And Dan only smiled, and, you know, he didn't say anything. I said, Dan, you know, I also know that some of your, you know, guys in the 442 were my classmates. One was Thomas Jichaku. He was killed in action in Anzio. And Shigeru Kanemoto, he was with Dan earlier, I guess, but I don't know what outfit he was in. Then there's Archie Soken, my classmate. Also Flash Nakagawa. I don't know what happened to these guys, too. Dan only smiled. He never said anything.
So you had been in the same Boy Scout troop with him all these years before, and it sounds like you were just saying that you thought about joining at a time where you would have ended up in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. That's not what your destiny would be in the military. We'll talk about that in a minute. But have you ever wondered how different your life would have been had you ended up with the 442nd?
Yeah, I often wonder about that because, you know, the guys that went in there, they took some heavy, you know, getting killed and everything. I often thought about that, too. I said I was fortunate that, in a way, I didn't go to Europe, but instead it's because of my language training that after I took my basic training in Schofield Barracks, they had a Japanese language school established there. Most people didn't know. But this language school, I attended about a month, and then this Navy, Lieutenant J.G. came by, and he was interviewing a lot of the guys that was in the school, and I apparently passed the language test because I was the only guy that he sent me to Tinian. The rest of them went to Okinawa. But it's because of my spoken language proficiency. Before the war, I went to 8th grade in a Japanese language school. It was for at least 1.5 hours after English school. So it was basically 3 o'clock to about 5 o'clock, plus 3 hours on Saturday morning. So I had a good command of the spoken language. But the kanji, the Chinese characters, I wasn't that good at. But the Navy was looking for people that could speak the language. See, we had to interpret.
And I don't want to make a leap here, but as I just think about this in retrospect and know where you did end up, and not that it was a cakewalk what you experienced, but if you didn't have those language skills, if you hadn't been that dedicated in your schoolwork and learning the Japanese language and other situations, then you might have ended up somewhere else. The language skills you had may have ended up saving your life. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's a fair estimate, because if I didn't pass that test, I would have probably gone overseas, maybe back to Italy or someplace. Sometimes being smart, you know, might be helpful.
He would know. It's time for our first break, but just a reminder, that new documentary, Hidden Heroes, debuts on the History Channel on Veterans Day, November 11th at 8 p.m. More of Clarence Suzuki's World War II memories when we come back. And another idea for you as we approach Veterans Day, how about visiting a military museum in your neck of the woods? If you were to go to the city that bills itself as the home of heroes, you might meet a museum docent who just turned 102. We'll hear his story as well when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR, has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com, for Central Valley Trailer Repair. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode preparing you for Veterans Day. That's coming up this Thursday, November 11th. So be on the lookout for observances in your hometown and put 8 p.m. on your calendar to check out the documentary debuting on the History Channel, Hidden Heroes, the Nisei Soldiers of World War II. It's complete with excerpts from some of the oral histories that the Gopher Broke National Education Center has been conducting with World War II veterans of Japanese ancestry since 1998. We hear a lot about the 442 and the 100th Infantry Battalion, but there were about 6,000 Nisei in something called the MIS, and that includes Clarence Suzuki.
MIS is Military Intelligence Service. The service was activated during the war from the Presidio of San Francisco, but because of Roosevelt's 9066 that issued on February the 19th, 1942, that school in the Presidio was closed, and the school moved to Camp Savage in Minnesota. And from there, it was, you know, getting too small. More and more students were coming to the school, so they transferred the students over to Fort Snelling, a bigger place. But I might have ended over there, or I could have ended up in the infantry, you know, gone into some other outfit, not the 442. But because of my language training, I was fortunate. I was sent to Tinian. They flew me on a C-54 with all the officers. I was the only enlisted man on that plane. Flew from Honolulu to Johnson Island to Kwajalein and landed in Guam. From Guam, I took another transport, DC-3, got to Tinian. So I stayed on Tinian as a Navy Japanese language interpreter. This was part of the military government at the time, and I also went to Saipan. But Saipan had a place called Shalan Kanoa. That's where the Chamorros were. Most of the other Chamorros were on the island of Guam.
The time where you were in the Saipan and Tinian area was right after those battles had been fought to win American control of those islands?
I was there after the post-war, you know, period, but we had to take care of the civilians. We also had captured the Japanese soldiers, and there were a few of them running around in the hills. So I carried a Smith & Wesson 38 to be on the safe side.
What did your duties consist of at this time, and what was the strategic importance that that you were carrying out?
The guys that were there earlier were with the 27th Infantry. They're the guys that was probably around 13 people headed by a Caucasian officer. But one of the guys in that outfit was Dick Kishiwe. He was from Hanford. He just passed away last year. But my duty was part of trying to help the civilians, you know, get back to normalcy. They were in a big camp called Camp Churro, but there was some soldiers hiding in the camps too. They would periodically kill one of their own guys, you know, one of the Japanese civilians, for being out of step with their doctrine. Plus, the ones that were prisoners, they had to be taken care of health-wise too. So we had a field hospital to take care of these people, the civilians and the soldiers. That's what we did on Tinian until they closed the base around April of 1946.
And when did you get there?
I got there August 15th, 1945, just after the war ended.
Right when the war ended, a couple weeks before they signed the treaty. Well, it strikes me, since Tinian was where the Enola Gay took off from to drop the bomb on Hiroshima. Where were you when you heard about that, and what was the significance for you?
Well, the bomb was dropped before I landed on Tinian, because I think August 6th and August 9th, I got there August 15th, about, you know, a couple of weeks after the bomb. But, you know, talking to the guys too, I mean, they were all shocked that they had a bomb there. We you know, we could go over to the base, Northfield. They had three bomb wings, B-29s. One was on Guam and one on Saipan, but Northfield on Tinian was the big air base. Post-war, I was able to go to the Enola Gay, and I had a picture taken with me in front of the airplane. But all the guys that were there before me, most of the guys were Navy that, you know, I was with. They were shocked, and you say, oh, my God, you know. they didn't know about the bomb. Two bombs, actually. My understanding, talking to these guys, you know, they were bombing Japan for some time already after we took Iwo Jima, the B-29s were already bombing Japan all over. And what they were doing was firebomb Tokyo and all the big cities, Nagoya, Osaka. So by the time August, you know, came around, there was no need to drop a bomb, an atom bomb, because Japan was already ready to surrender. But the emperor didn't come out soon enough, and that's why the first bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. But my understanding is that the bomb was not intended for Hiroshima. It was intended for Kure. Kure was a naval base, big one, right north of Hiroshima. But because it was all clouded over, they couldn't see the target. So they kept going south, and then this Hiroshima, it's all clear. So my understanding is, hey, you know, why not drop the bomb there already? Get the hell out of there. But the same thing happened on August 9th on Nagasaki. The intended target was, forgot the naval base. Yeah, it was on the island of Kyushu, right across from Honshu. But that was also a big naval base. That's where the bomb was supposed to be dropped. But it was clouded over. They went down south. They passed another naval base, Sasebo. That was also clouded over. Then they came towards the Nagasaki, and there it's all bright and clear. Drop the damn thing and get out of here. So, I mean, you know, this is what I think happened. Mm-hmm. There's no way I can prove that that's true.
Do you feel, I know you say you felt the Imperial Japan was ready to surrender before that, but do you feel that that sped up the end of the war and maybe spared you from some other situations you might have encountered?
Yeah, I think personally that President Truman made the right decision based on what the military was telling him. If they didn't drop the bomb, we had to go in, there would be so many U.S. soldiers there, so many Japanese soldiers, and both sides would have taken huge losses. The estimate was maybe the U.S. would lose 510,000 men, Japanese would lose maybe 2 million. So if Olympia went through and then continued on, it would have gone into the island of Honshu, and more people would have got killed. So what President Truman saw was it was the right thing to do to end the war with the bomb, atom bomb. By doing that, he saved so many million lives. And that's my understanding why the bomb was dropped in the first place.
So the work that you did as a translator, interpreter, and interrogator, first there on Saipan and Tinian, how aware were you of what had happened there? The thing that jumps out at me for Saipan is that suicide cliff where so many Japanese were deceived into taking their own lives, even their children's lives. Is that something that became clear to you at the time as you talked to some of the locals in their language?
Yeah, actually, I was there after the war, so I don't know too much what happened, but I read about it. So there's a Hawaiian guy, Kubo. He was kind of a brave soldier. He was with the 27th Infantry. He would go into a cave where there were some holdout soldiers, but the soldiers were keeping some civilians hostage too. So he went in several times, unarmed, try to get some 20 soldiers to surrender. The third time out, he finally got the right message to them, and he told the soldiers, don't die for the emperor, stay alive for your family. So that's what turned them over to his side, and they surrendered, and then all the civilians came behind them. Bob Kubo also got the information that there was going to be a gyokusai. Gyokusai is a suicide banzai charge, and it would be in a couple of days. Yeah, this was before the end of the war, and it was still in 1944. But Bob Kubo was able to get the information that there's going to be this gyokusai, and he related to his commanding officers, and they got ready for that gyokusai charge, and they wiped them all out. But because of Bob's bravery, he got the soldiers to surrender and got the information about the gyokusai. He was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal, the third highest, you know, award. But he's the only Nisei in the Pacific that I know had won a, you know, honor, like a, you know, Distinguished Service Medal. Most of the other guys, like Dick Kishiwe, who was a 27th Infantry, same outfit, he only got probably a Bronze Star Combat Infantry badge. But Most of the other guys, they never got anything.
Until 10 years ago this week, when all Nisei veterans of World War II were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. I have some relevant links posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com, including that trailer for the new documentary, Hidden Heroes. And another milestone reached in the last week, birthday number 102 for a man who might be the oldest museum docent in America. His name is Bill Barrett, and you'll find him every Saturday at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum in Pueblo, Colorado, where Bill decided to volunteer over a decade ago when he was only 91.
I was beginning to be a little bored staying at home, so I kind of looked around for something to do. I saw an ad in our local paper that they were needing help here at the museum. So I came out and talked to him, and I was hired to be a volunteer, and I've been here ever since.
And you spend most of your time in the gift shop,
I do, yes. I do not walk too well anymore, and there's a lot of walking to if you're a tour guide.
What are the big items in the gift shop that you see a lot of people snatching up?
We have a lot of toys for kids, a lot of airplanes, and a lot of our stuff goes to kids, especially if they're with Grandpa.
Yeah, and I bet they are. And you have two hangars worth of historic aircrafts here. Do you have a favorite? Is something that's on display at this museum?
Probably my favorite at the museum is the B-29 that we have here. We call it Peachy, and the reason it is called Peachy is that there was a young man from Pueblo that was a B-29 pilot. He had a sister he called Peachy. So when we got the aircraft here, we had to name it Peachy.
I guess you did, yeah. Does it look like the ones you saw in the Pacific during World War II?
Very much so.
And Pueblo has quite a history with World War II. This airstrip we're next to had some bombers flying off of it.
They trained the crews here for the B-24s, the B-29s, and the B-17s.
So the B-29 here is your favorite. Is there another one or two that you see a lot of people gravitating towards?
And different people like different planes. I like the A-26 real well. And my favorite plane during World War II was the P-38 Lightning.
Well, and you have a picture of yourself on the most famous P-38 Lightning that ever existed, and we're going to get that story from you before we're done here. But the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum is open 7 days a week. If you're lucky, you might run into Bill.
Yes.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
I was working at the drugstore that Sunday. When I got home, I didn't know anything about it at the store, but when I got home, the radio was on and was hearing about what had happened.
Was that pretty jarring?
Yes, it was.
Did you know where Pearl Harbor was?
Not exactly. I knew where Hawaii was, but I didn't know Pearl Harbor.
Had you ever even considered the prospect of war?
No.
Nothing?
No, I never did.
And now all of a sudden, the Japanese have attacked American territory.
Right.
So what'd you do about it?
The war started in December. In January, I went to Kansas City, Missouri, enlisted in the Army, signed some papers, talked to a number of people, and they sent me back home to quit my job and come back at a later date to be inducted.
Why'd you do that? Why did you want to get in the Army? You had a good job.
I just figured I had to do it.
Your country needed you.
Your country needed it.
And you didn't want to wait to be drafted.
I didn't want to be drafted, yeah. I don't know how soon I would have been drafted. At that time, they had drawings for the draft. Everybody had a number, and then every once in a while they'd have a draft and draw out the different numbers.
Did you have an expectation of what you might be doing in the Army?
I had no idea. They didn't ask me what I wanted to do. I would just wound up in the Signal Corps, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and a lot of people these days aren't familiar with the Signal Corps. Or if they do ever hear the Signal Corps, it's maybe they see a photograph from 70 years ago, and it says U.S. Signal Corps at the bottom. So tell us about the Signal Corps.
They sent me from Kansas City to Jefferson Barracks in Missouri. I was just there for a few days, then I went to Camp Crowder, Missouri, which was an Army Signal Corps training center. The Signal Corps was the Army's way of communicating. Mm-hmm. They did it by radio, telephone, telegraph, in person, carrier pigeon. I don't think we ever used that in where I was, but they used motorcycles some and different types of ways to communicate.
But you probably also had to go through basic training too, right?
Basic training was more or less some of the Signal Corps things that you had to do. I knew how to type because I took typing in high school. I tried to learn the Morse code, but I didn't have the ear for those dots and dashes. Then I got some cryptography training when he was there at Camp Crowder.
Cryptography. So tell us what cryptography is.
Cryptography is the encoding and decoding of messages. From our signal center, every message that went out, every message that came in had to be in code. It was our job to put it into code or decode it and deliver the message to the proper authority.
Did it take you a while to get a handle for that?
Not too much. We had a machine that did a lot of it.
What was that machine called?
It was called SIGABA, S-I-G-A-B-A.
How big was it?
About the size of a teletype machine.
Today, people carry a little machine around in their hand called a smartphone that can outcompute just about anything. But, you know, spatially, how much space did that take
up? Probably as big as your laptop.
All right.
Yeah. Only it was complete, you know, didn't have a frame that came up, or this that came up.
Big and thick and kind of heavy?
Yeah. Real heavy. Yeah.
So what could that machine do?
It encoded and decoded the machines for us.
So you could type in a message in plain English?
Right.
And it would turn it into a code?
Into a code. The way we got that code, the machine had 10 wheels on it.
Uh-huh.
And you had to set those wheels. The first five wheels we set every day at the same – the wheels had the 26 letters, the alphabet on it, each wheel. And then each morning or each at midnight, you had to set those five wheels at a certain number or letters.
Right.
That was given to us by a book we had that told us how to set it. And then on every message, the first 10 digits on the message that came in told us where to set the second wheel.
Okay.
And then you just typed your message and it either decoded or encoded.
So if you get one of those wheels off by one, the whole thing doesn't make any sense.
I don't know.
You never found out?
I never found out about that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So if everything has to be encoded, it means that the nature of these messages that are being transmitted must be fairly sensitive.
We had several different types of messages. We had the routine messages. We had priority messages. We had secret and top secret, but there was five different classifications of messages.
It's time for another break, but we will hear more of Bill Barrett's unique World War II story when we come back. Pueblo, Colorado, the home of heroes, is where you'll find them every Saturday at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. Selma, you can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit, and don't leave without visiting that wall of honor. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, reminding you that with Veterans Day approaching on Thursday, November 11th, to be ready to salute all those who have served, but especially those in your circle. Make it a point to personally thank those you know. And when you're looking for heroes, Pueblo, Colorado is a pretty good place to start. It is known as the home of heroes, thanks to 4 Medal of Honor recipients that are from Pueblo, and also a breathtaking public memorial there that lists the names of every American who has ever been awarded the Medal of Honor. It's also home to the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum, where one of the docents, Bill Barrett, celebrated his 102nd birthday this past week. You heard him talk about his role in encoding and decoding important messages in the Pacific.
Did you feel a sense of responsibility or maybe even pressure to not mess this up?
Well, probably yes. I was the non-commissioned officer in charge of the Signal Center. After I made staff sergeant, they promoted me to in charge of the Signal Center. I didn't do a lot of coding and decoding after that. I more or less had to see that everything got done.
And were you hoping to head overseas, or would you have been just fine staying stateside?
I figured I would be sent overseas, yes.
And you went over pretty early.
Yes, I did. 6 months after I was in the service, I was sent overseas. September 1st.
September 1st, 1942.
We left the States.
Where'd you go?
Well, I tell people that I had a 29-day all-expense-paid cruise to Brisbane, Australia from San Francisco with a 3-day stopover in the Fiji Islands.
Sounds pretty luxurious, Bill.
Well, accommodations weren't like they are today on a cruise.
Had you ever been at sea before?
No, I had not.
I was going to say, young guy from Kansas, maybe a creek or a river is about as big as it gets.
I've been in the small boat.
Uh-huh.
Going fishing or something.
So you spend a month on a big old ship with
right.
a bunch of guys.
Yeah, right.
What was that like?
Very crowded. The food wasn't that great. Accommodations weren't that great. Down in the hold, there were about 4 decks of bunks that mm-hmm. you had to sleep in. And it was hot and sticky down there. And we would sleep out on deck if the weather was decent and if you could find a spot to...
if nobody else beat you to
beat
it.
Beat you
huh?
to it, yeah.
How about submarines? Was there a concern that you guys would be in danger?
I think there was because... when you're going overseas during the wartime, you zigzag.
Yeah.
And that's for submarine protection. And it takes longer going over than it does coming back when we came back because of the zigzag.
So you get to Australia.
Right.
And what's next?
Got off the ship. They took us up to a little town called Ipswich, Australia, where there was an army an air base called Amberley Field. And I understand, I've talked to some people from Australia, that Amberley Field is still there.
How about that?
Yeah. We spent about 3 months there, and we didn't do a lot. They had us out in the field about a half a mile away from the main camp, and we had to walk down there to our meals and stuff. We didn't do any communication until we got to New Guinea.
You know, and I'm always struck by this aspect of you guys who lived through this time, because we have the benefit of hindsight now. We can tell you, hey, December 7th, 1941 to mid-August 1945. That was World War II for America. But when you get over there in late 1942, how long did you think this was going to last? I mean, do you have any idea how long you're going to be out there?
I had no idea.
Did you think it might be over in a year or two?
Oh, no. No, we didn't. Knew it wasn't going to be over that soon.
You're in for the long haul.
Long haul, yep.
Did you think you might be in danger?
No.
No? Even though...
Not in our conditions, no. We had a lot of air raids, and that was all. I wasn't in the combat unit, and there wasn't any fighting close by. But we did have several air raids, and we actually lost some people in our unit in air raids.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's dangerous. Japanese bombers can kill you.
Yeah, that's true.
and before I get further with your experience in the Pacific, what about Lillian? What'd you say to her when you said goodbye?
I don't know.
Did you think you were going to come back and see her again?
Well... You never know. At that time, I didn't know what I was going to be in.
Mm-hmm.
However, when I was in Camp Crowder, my grandmother Barrett passed away, and I didn't get a 3-day pass to go home to her funeral. It took me a day to get there. So right after the funeral, I had to go back to Kansas City, and then the next morning catch a train back to Camp Crowder. She did go back to Kansas City with me. She had a sister that lived in Kansas City. So we stayed there that night, and the next morning I had to say goodbye and never saw her again until November 45.
Wow. Did you get a few letters from her during that time?
I got a lot of letters from her, an awful lot of letters. I was unable to keep them. I had no way to do that, but she kept every letter that I wrote to her.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's how I wrote this, is from those letters.
You've got some of those letters. You put personal history together a few
right.
years ago.
Right.
While we're on that topic, here you are, on the other side of the world from Kansas. What did it mean to you to get those letters from your girl?
It meant an awful lot to get them from my girl and my family also. My folks wrote quite often. My sister wrote quite often. I didn't hear too much from my brothers, for they were both in the service also.
Yeah, where did they end up?
One of them was in infantry in France. My other one was in Germany, and he was in intelligence some way. He never did talk too much about it.
But all three of you came home?
All three of us came home. My oldest brother was in Normandy about 3 or 4 days after they invaded it. He did get injured and got some shrapnel in his leg. They sent him back to a hospital and for a few days and then right back to the front.
Well, your family certainly made its contribution. Without question. So for you, you said 3 months there at Ipswich?
Then up to Port Moresby, New Guinea. December 5th of 42, we left Australia. Our company occupied the first hold of the ship, a makeshift ladder to go up and down, and we had to sleep on the floor. It took 6 days to reach our destination.
So then you get to New Guinea.
Right.
And you're going to spend the next year and a half there?
Yes, from December 42 to May of 44.
So you must have gotten used to it.
Oh, yeah. But I spent about three different areas.
Uh-huh.
We were at near Port Moresby, at Milne Bay, and at Ora Bay.
And what kind of work were you doing?
Communications. We were the first telephone exchange, American telephone exchange in New Guinea.
Uh-huh. Can you give us a sense of the nature of these communications? Are you aware of what's being communicated all the time?
On some of them. We had to send a lot of reports back to headquarters at the end of the day. That's uh-huh. where it kept us busy most of the night. That's where we saved the routine messages for that communication that went back to headquarters. We knew some of the things that were going to happen during the war. Maybe knew what was going to happen, but we didn't know exactly where or when.
Now you're talking about like invasions, islands?
Landings and stuff like that.
Yeah. Is that hard to think about when you know something like that's going to happen? I mean, do you think about those young men who are going to be crashing onto those beaches?
Oh, sure you do, yeah. You think about them, worry about them, and wonder how many of them is going to survive.
Yeah. And how about the role of communications in general? I mean, what would have happened if those messages that you're receiving and sending don't get through?
I don't know.
Probably would have cost some people some lives, right?
It could have, yeah. After I finished this book, this is how I ended it.
Right.
I was not wading the shore at Omaha Beach. I was not fighting the enemy across the fields and towns of France and Germany. I was not flying in an airplane bombing the cities of Europe, or flying a fighter plane escorting our bombers, or shooting down enemy planes. I was not fighting in the jungles of New Guinea, or storming a beach of some island in the South Pacific. I was not one of the 400,000 that never made it back home. However, the 912 Signal Company I was assigned to had a significant role in the war in the South Pacific. The supply of the final equipment and the operation of communications for all the units of General George C. Kennedy's 5th Air Force in New Guinea was the mission of the 912 Signal Company. In conjunction with the 27th Air Depot Group, the organization was awarded the Presidential Unit Citation for Outstanding Merited Service and Achievement during the Papuan Campaign. The model signal depot established by the 912 Signal Company at Port Moresby has become the criterion upon which all other Signal Corps units of the Far East Air Force have been set up. From the 13th of December 1942 to 25th of April 45, when the unit left Port Moresby to set up a signal depot in the Netherlands New Indies, the 912 Signal Company has played a significant part in turning back the Japanese and in hoping to help make the eventual doom of the Japanese Empire.
So they said, you guys are the standard.
Yeah.
Your right. signal company. That's how they want them all to work.
That's right. The very first night we got into Port Moresby, we had an air raid.
Very first night.
Very first night.
Welcome to Port Moresby, Bill.
Yeah. So all we could do was just stand there and look.
And what do you see?
We had set up our Well, you see the planes in the searchlights.
And you see bombs coming out of the planes?
You couldn't see them, no, but you could hear them after they hit.
How close did they hit to where you were?
Just over the hill at the airstrip.
Uh-huh.
One night later on, a plane did sneak in behind one of our airplanes and drop some bombs, and one of them landed in a theater area, and it just happened that the movie had been over for a few minutes, so there were a few kids still hanging around, and some of them were killed. In fact, we lost three kids from our outfit that night.
From your company?
From our company, yeah.
And a couple things here. So if it had been 5 minutes earlier, you would have lost a lot.
Lost a lot of people, yeah.
Were you in the theater?
No, I did not go that night.
Did you usually go?
I went to a lot of theaters because that's about the only thing there was to do at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why didn't you go that night?
I have no idea. I might have been working.
It's okay,
possible,
sure.
It's possible I could have been working that night.
And the young men who were killed, did you know any of them?
I know all three of them because they were in my communications.
So you'd spent quite a lot of time with these guys.
Oh, yeah.
How hard was that for you to deal with?
It was pretty hard to miss him, especially one of them in particular was a very intelligent gentleman, very nice gentleman, and had a lot of stories to tell, and he was really a character, and we really enjoyed, everybody enjoyed him, and we really missed him.
Did that kind of change the tenor of your company after that?
I don't think so, no.
Did you ever feel like, well, maybe that could happen to me, too?
It's possible. Very possible, yeah.
Were you prepared for that?
Well, you take it as it came. If you got hit, you got hit. When they start dropping those bombs, you never know where they're going to go.
I'm sure a lot of your visitors here at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum know who Dick Bong was.
A lot of them don't.
Well, you get to educate them then, right?
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of them about it and showed them the pictures that I have. Yeah.
So tell me how this all developed. You guys were actually sending the message that the record for the most aerial victories had been broken?
No, we knew, I forget how, but we do know that he broke this record.
Yeah, so Dick Bong was a P-38 pilot in the Pacific.
Right.
And the record for kills in aerial combat was held for a long time by Eddie Rickenbacker
in
World War One.
World War One, yeah.
But Bong ends up breaking it in his P-38.
Yeah, by shooting down 27 enemy planes. Rickenbacker did 26.
So Bong gets his 27th.
Right.
You guys hear about it.
Right. And so a couple of days later, some of my friends and I went over to the airstrip to see if we could find his plane, and we were lucky enough to find it. And I happened to have my camera with me. I got a picture of his plane, the whole plane. I got a picture of the 27 flags painted on the side of the fuselage. Mm-hmm. And then I have a picture of me and one of my buddies sitting on the wing of his plane.
It's a great picture. I'm going to put that up at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I wonder how many people have a picture like that, Bill.
Not very many, I don't think. Yeah. On the plane, yeah.
Did you have to ask anybody's permission?
No, there wasn't anybody there but the three of us.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, wasn't anybody around the plane at all that day.
And he wasn't done.
Oh, no, he ended up doing 40.
How amazing is that?
Yeah, that's amazing, yeah.
So he breaks the record, and then MacArthur's coming to Port Moresby to congratulate him.
To congratulate him, yeah.
And you were there?
I was there. Well, this was the same day that we were saw the plane.
Uh-huh.
And around one of the, we call them a revetment? Uh-huh. Revetment, yeah. There was a bunch of people standing, and one of the guys come over and talked to us. He must have been one of the photographers or reporters or something. He said, if you guys want to stick around a while, they'll make with your time. But they wouldn't let us get very close.
Uh-huh.
In fact, we kind of had to set up on the top of the revetment. And pretty soon the plane came in, and MacArthur came out of it. And I didn't get a picture of him, but so far away you couldn't hardly tell who it was, except he was a little bit taller than everybody else. And somehow I lost that picture. I don't know what happened to it.
But you still have the memory.
I still have the memory of seeing him, yeah.
Was there some celebration out where you were when you guys got that news that Japan had surrendered?
Quite a bit. A lot of guys were shooting off their guns and had fire. I don't know where they got fireworks, but some of them had fireworks and stuff. I have no idea where they came from. Mostly with guns going off and guys hollering, and both when Japan surrendered and when Germany surrendered. Same thing.
How excited were you to come home?
Really excited. You'll never know how excited you are to get it discharged and get to come home and see your family and your girlfriend. That was the highlight of my Army career, I think.
Well, tell me about that moment. How did that all unfold?
I was discharged in Denver, and I came home on Rock Island Rocket, which is a train that came through my hometown. And my dad and my little sister, my girlfriend, and I don't know, 8 or 10, 12 of my friends were all there to greet me. It was a great time to see all of them and get to hug my girlfriend and get a kiss her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys didn't have that experience.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of them never came home.
Some, even if they did, 3 years is a long time to wait for a boyfriend.
Well, that's true. A lot of them got Dear John letters.
I'm sure there were some guys in Belleville that had eyes on Lillian.
Well, yeah, I'm sure of that.
So how long did you wait to pop the question?
I'm not sure how soon we talked about it, but we were married less than a month later.
So you wait all of a month to get married to Lillian after she's waited for you to get home for 3 years. You guys go on to have a couple sons. You've got a couple granddaughters. You ever think about what if? What if you were in the theater that night? What if you were one of those more than 406,000 Americans who didn't come home?
Yeah. What if I never made it home? Well, there wouldn't be two great boys, two great granddaughters.
Yeah. How does that make you feel?
Yeah. Makes me feel pretty proud of all my family.
Have you been back to Washington and the National World War II Memorial?
Oh, yes. I got on that honor flight
that
they have. Are you familiar with that?
Very.
Okay. I went with that with my brother. he and I went together.
You and your brother got to go together.
On the honor flight out of Denver.
How much trouble did you guys cause?
I don't know. He was in a wheelchair most of the time. He was getting along. He was 2 years older than I was.
Tell me about that experience. What'd you get out of it?
Oh, it's a great experience for me, especially being with him. Meant a lot to me, seeing it together.
And I know you tend to downplay your time in the war, even though you were overseas a lot longer than most World War II veterans.
That's true, yeah.
Did that honor flight experience, the way people treated you in D.C., the way they treated you back here in Colorado when you came back, did that give you a new perspective on what you had done and what it meant to people?
Well, not really. You know, I feel what I did was necessary. It had to be done. But I feel sorry for all those guys that were in the infantry and fighting and all that kind of stuff. And with what they did and what I did, I don't think I did too much. That's my feelings.
Well, I've heard a lot of guys say that to me. But but the rest of us know that we wouldn't be here without you.
Yeah, that's
your
true.
Sons wouldn't have been born, for sure, if you didn't come home.
Yeah.
The world would be a much different place.
That's true.
If you hadn't done what you did.
Yeah.
That memorial itself, when you look at all those gold stars,
what
comes to mind? What'd you think about when you were looking at that?
Well, you feel sorry for them and didn't make it back home.
Were there any moments of that trip back to D.C. that kind of stand out for you that were real impressive or meant something to you?
Yes. And they had Europe on one side, the Pacific on the other side, and they had the one named New Guinea.
Uh-huh.
And I spent a lot of time in New Guinea, so I got down beside it and had my son take a picture of me with the New Guinean right beside me. That might have been one of my highlights.
I bet when you're here in this gift shop, you get some opportunities to talk to people who certainly weren't alive when World War II was happening.
Right, yeah.
What's the most important thing that you think people need to know about what happened, about the young men and women that served our country during that time?
Well, I think they need to think about the people that never made it back home. They need to think about the people that served. That's about it.
What would you say that you're most proud of, Bill?
During my service?
In life in general, sure.
Oh, well, being married and having my family.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But during the war, I think probably what we did, the communication that we did for the service, probably the most important thing I did.
Were there ever nights over there in the Pacific where you're sitting in that tent and you're wondering, am I ever going to see Lillian again?
Yeah, you never knew. You could get hit, like I say, get hit in an air raid or have an accident of some kind and not make it.
He made it, and he's still making it to the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum in Pueblo, Colorado, every Saturday, even at age 102. So often on this program, we talk to veterans who experienced intense combat on the ground, at sea, or in the air. But Veterans Day this week is our chance to thank not just those, but all who have served in any capacity. And I hope the examples we heard from Clarence Suzuki and Bill Barrett today serve as a reminder that every single role was crucial in preserving freedom during World War II, just as they are today and just as they will be in the future. So make sure to thank the veterans in your life this week and join us again next time on Hometown Heroes, where we try to remember on Veterans Day and every day that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.